S-T-O-R-G-E means affection, the sort of love there ought to be between near relations. Philia, P-H-I-L-I-A, means friendship. Eros, E-R-O-S, is of course the love between the sexes. And agape, A-G-A-P-E, is love in the Christian sense, God's love for man and the Christian love for the brethren. I want to talk about all four, and I'll begin with storge, or affection. Almost anyone, it seems, can be loved with storge. The ugly, the stupid, even the exasperating can be its objects. There need be no apparent fitness between those whom it unites. It ignores even the barriers between species. We see it not only between dog and man, but, more surprisingly, between dog and cat. What's common to all the objects of storge is that they are familiar. We can often identify the very day and hour when a friendship began or when we fell in love, but we never catch storge at the moment of its beginning. To become aware of it is to become aware that it's already been going on for some time. In our storge, we're rather like the dogs, who wag their tails at familiar people even if they've never done them any kindness, and bark at strangers even if they've never done them any harm. This apparently indiscriminate character in storge and its dependence on familiarity point to its animal and biological origins. Let me say at once, for this will often come across us in the following talks, that I don't mean the word animal to be derogatory. Nothing in man is either better or worse for being shared with the beasts. The distinction between what we share and what is specifically human is not a moral one. When we blame a man for behaving like a beast, we mean that he displays characteristics common to man and beast on occasions where those peculiar to man were demanded. What we call brutality in man, say in a Russian or German torturer, is usually behavior which the brutes in fact don't exhibit. My Greek lexicon defines storge as affection, especially of parents to offspring. And that, I've no doubt, is the original form of the thing, as well as the central meaning of the word. We understand the later, more remote ramifications of it if we start with the right basic image. A mother nursing a baby, a bitch or a cat with a basket full of puppies or kittens, all in a squealing, nuzzling heap together, continuously moving yet somehow at rest, a warm animal smell and all the noises. But while the original form of storge is thus seen in the nursery or the basket, it branches out in all directions. But however far storge travels from its source, it still retains from it a strong flavor. It's usually the humblest of the loves. It gives itself no airs. Storge is modest, even furtive and shamefaced. Storge has a very homely face, so have many of those for whom we feel it. It's no proof of your cleverness or perceptiveness or refinement that you love them, nor that they love you. To have to produce storge in public is like getting your household furniture out for a move. It was all right in its native place, but it looks tawdry out of doors. And the feeling of storge is so nearly organic, so gradual, so unemphatic, that you could no more pride yourself on it than on getting sleepy towards bedtime. It lives with humble, undressed, private things. The thump of a drowsy dog's tail on the kitchen floor, the sound of a sewing machine, easy laughter and easy tears on some shrewd and wrinkled old face, a toy left on the lawn. It's the most comfortable and least ecstatic of loves. It is to our emotions what soft slippers and an easy, almost worn-out chair and old clothes are to our bodies. Wraps you round like a blanket, almost like sleep. At its best, gives you the pleasures, the ease and relaxation of solitude, without solitude itself. If we were talking about drinks, our section on gin, we'd certainly have to note the fact that besides being a drink in its own right, gin is an excellent base or medium for several mixed drinks. Storge is similarly a base or medium for other loves. Being the oldest, most spontaneous form in which we go out of ourselves towards others, it is naturally taken up both into friendship and into eros. One might say it clothes them. In the end, all those things about your friends, which had nothing to do with the friendship originally, become dear because they become familiar. As for more distressing than to experience it for more than a very short time without stalking. Every good marriage, even every courtship, makes for its Eros, so to speak, a nest of stalking, like the nest of rice you build for your helping of curry. This relation between Eros and Storge is well seen in the two outward expressions they have in common. One is the kiss. Which followed this from the other, I don't know. It's not enough to say that you kiss your child and you kiss the woman you love, but in very different ways. For kisses between lovers aren't always lovers' kisses. The truth is that Storge kisses in one way only, while Eros kisses both in Storge's way and in his own, expressing sometimes the most transporting passion, sometimes quiet affection, and often many intermediate states in between. The second expression in common is more embarrassing. Lovers as well as parents tend to indulge in baby language. This makes many modern people, me among them, uncomfortable. I've spoken of Storge so far mainly in terms of comfort and heart's ease, something that oils the wheels of life. But it has far higher values. It comes near to Agape's power of loving the unlovable. It certainly loves the unattractive. It doesn't do this quite in Agape's way. Another, say, loves an intrinsically unlovable son because nature compels her, because in caring for him she fulfills a need of her own. Storge, without being Agape, imitates her actions. Then secondly, as we've seen, it's familiarity that qualifies people to be the object of stalking. And of course it's the circumstances of our lives, many of them accidental, grown up we hardly know how, that have made them familiar. We haven't chosen them. They can include men whom we should never have selected as friends, and women with whom we could never conceivably have fallen in love. Familiarity teaches us first to endure and then to enjoy. Humanity in forms most alien to us, as habit teaches us to like foods we didn't naturally like. Lovers and friends feel, it's not always a delusion, that they were made for one another. The glory of Storge is that it unites those who most emphatically, even comically, are not. The acquaintances we make for ourselves are, of course, chosen to suit our own tastes, people of our sort. The possible objects of Storge are just whoever happens to live under the same roof or meet you every day. You need a really Catholic taste to be able to get something out of any odd collection of books found in a hotel. You may need only a very narrow one to enjoy all the books in your own study. You chose them. When we thus come to love the unattractive, what is unattractive to us, we're often led on to a momentous and sobering discovery. We find in them, it may be, great humor, sense, or even goodness. Not goodness of some particular kind that happens to please our own palate, just goodness. We shouldn't have noticed it if mere familiarity hadn't bred affection. It wouldn't have attracted us. We now see that it ought to have. We learn how very narrow our range of appreciation is, how little taste for goodness we have, except when it's dressed and served to suit our idiosyncrasy. But mellowed by Storge, we almost reach the stage of loving goodness itself. Now at this point we must be on our guard. For really, from everything that's been said, the resemblance between Agape and Storge is astonishing. Storge is not puffed up. It suffers long and is kind. It loves the unlovable. It also loves goodness, which is the essentially lovable. We might be tempted to identify the two, to say that what I've been calling Storge is not a special and wholly natural kind of love, but love itself, or goodness, the rightful sovereign of the world. Such identification seems implicit in much 19th century fiction, in Trollope, in Thackeray, even at times in George Eliot. The conflict between good and evil natural impulse, however innocent in itself, may stand between God and us and so become an idol. But that's not the side of the thing I want to emphasize at the moment. These authors also take insufficient notice of some facts about Storge which are discernible without Christian instruction. They're a matter of common observation and bitter experience. I leave out of account for the moment its danger as a possible rival to God. How often, how long, if left to her merely natural workings, does Storge succeed in realizing even the natural and this worldly good which she seems to promise? Storge, unless she submits to something higher than herself, does not remain Storge. This natural love carries in itself the seeds of natural hatred. Every one of its characteristics is ambivalent. Almost anyone, I've said, may be loved by Storge. Yes, and most of us expect to be. The egregious Mr. Pontifex, in Samuel Butler's Way of All Flesh, is shocked that his son doesn't love him. It's unnatural that a boy should not love his own father. He assumes that Storge is a sort of love laid on or built in by nature. It's ready-made. It's on the house. We need to do nothing to deserve it. Storge is often assumed as a right, and often the party who has done nothing lovable hungers to be loved, and continues to be not only disappointed, but shocked and outraged because he's not. And once this situation exists, it will continually worsen. If someone's already unlovable, the continual demand on his part to be loved as of right, his sense of injury, creating us a sense of guilt, guilt for a fault we couldn't have avoided, and can't by any effort of will cease to commit. For if in some favored moment any germ of affection stirs in us, his demand for more and still more freezes us up again, and each becomes a torment to the other. I once knew a mother who incessantly complained of her adolescent daughter's lack of affection. What more could I do for her than I do, she asked. I live for her. And the pitiful fact is that this was, in a sense, true. She was no frivolous, neglectful, or self-indulgent mother. She worked hard for the girl, denied herself lots for her, was always making things for her, giving her presents, arranging treats. But it never occurred to her to consider whether all these things and presents and treats were those the girl wanted. Though often complaining that the daughter didn't confide in her, she never in any serious degree listened to anything the daughter said. The dawning interests of adolescence were swept aside with jokes. Needless to add, any effort made by the daughter to put her own point of view on a disputed matter was a total failure. If she put it at all trenchantly, she met reproaches and finally temper. If she put it gently, she was met by sobs and embraces and cuddlings and pet names. For the mother held the common belief that scenes, as they are very justly called, of affection, solve all problems and remove all tensions. In reality, of course, they usually leave things just where they were, unless, indeed, the debauch of emotion, like other debauches, leaves a hangover. All part of this mother's unlovableness consisted in downright bad manners. We're always hearing complaints about the rudeness of the rising generation. But though I'm nearly 60 myself, I'm far more often impressed with the rudeness of parents to their children. Who has not been the embarrassed guest at family dinners where one or other of the parents treated their grown-up offspring with an incivility which, practiced on any other young people, would have terminated the acquaintance? Ruthless interruption, flat contradiction, loud ridicule of things the children take seriously or even hold sacred, insulting references to their best friends, dogmatic assertions in matters home is, or should be, a place where formality of manners isn't required, they think it's a place where no manners are required. Of course, the mistake is made only by people of a certain inner and essential grossness. Those who leave their good manners behind them when they come home from the party can have had no really good manners even there. But of course, in such a mother as I'm speaking of, there's a far darker streak. The daughter is to have everything she can give, but if possible, nothing that anything or anyone else gives. This is important because it's not a departure from Storge, it's a congenital malady in Storge. Storge's born with the tendency to it. It's not a weakness which needs specially adverse conditions to bring it out. It will come out unless measures are taken to guard against it. And you see how it naturally arises from the very origins of Storge. The whole appeal of the baby or of the young is their total dependence on the mother. And of course, it's not only mothers who respond to that. We all, in some measure, feel the appeal of the helpless. And if in supplying their needs, we also gratify an emotional need of our own, there's no harm in that. A duty is none the worse for being also a pleasure. Yes. But of course, as the creature ceases to be helpless, this particular pleasure will cease. All the activities involved in caring for a child, for instance, are directed to that end. We feed it and wash it and teach it to walk and talk in order that it may presently do all these things without our help. We are, or should be, laboring to make ourselves unnecessary. Does the knowledge, I am no longer necessary, strike like a nail? If so, we must, I believe, conclude that our Storge was not the sort of love that desires the good of its object. We have desired for it not good as such, but only that mountain kind of good which we could gratify our own need by giving. Those who cannot bear to become unnecessary have various ways of dealing with the situation. The least mischievous is to set up a substitute object such as a spoiled dog. Much less desirable is the attempt to persuade yourself that you still are needed after all. This, of course, is done by inventing imaginary needs in the other parties. You can thus work your fingers to the bone doing things for your family. True, a moment's reflection, or even your family's repeated assertions, would tell you that most of these things were unnecessary, undesired, and a perfect nuisance to everybody. It's no use to tell the corresponding type of woman that she'd much better discontinue her works of supererogation, because if she did, she would be faced with the very fact she's trying to avoid. So long as she keeps on, she can feel necessary. And she has also other gratifications. The laboriousness reassures her about the quality of her love, a subject on which she has repressed doubts. It whispers to her, as long as her back aches and her feet burn, how much I must love them if I do all this. But also, more terribly, the unappreciativeness of the others, the unforgettable wounding words, for any words will wound a person of that sort, in which they point out that the laundry really does the washing very much better and they can afford to send it out, or that they all actually prefer cold luncheons, give her what seems just cause for her feeling of ill usage. Therefore, for the sweets of resentment, she is so obviously in the right and they in the wrong. But can resentment be sweet to those who love? It's perhaps a question of terminology. Certainly, ordinary usage allows us to describe as love many states which already contain a very substantial ingredient of hatred. It's, of course, a gross error to suppose that jealousy is specially associated with erotic love. Even in the injured wife or husband, the feeling has often quite as much to do with wounded stalking as with the infringement of sexual possession. Christian. I used to think that both these were due to a sort of disinterested hatred, the one for what is intellectually high, and the other for God himself, God who is in the long run the supreme object of all human jealousies. But perhaps it's not quite so bad as that. It's the reaction to desertion. One who is all ours has become in part a stranger. And above all, change has begun. The seemingly immemorial order has cracked. This is the beginning of the end, the first breath of winter. For Storky, whose very food is the familiar, dislikes alteration. Sometimes a curious double jealousy is felt. We're jealous of the new interest because it has stolen the heart we love. But it's possible at the very same moment to be jealous the other way round. Supposing for a moment there were, after all, anything in all this classical music or this religion, why in heaven's name should he or she see it when we don't? Why should they be selected for admission to it? Why not we? The mildest and safest line the older generation sees with such jealousy can take is to say, tolerantly, indulgently, it's a phase, it'll all blow over. This is a capital device, for it's very galling to the chit or whippersnapper you're talking at, and at the same time not very easy to resent. It even has the incidental advantage that you may believe it. Better still, it may even turn out to be true, and it won't be our fault if it doesn't. I was talking about story or affection in its depraved form. I don't think we gain much by describing these nasty states of mind as neuroses. If the word means that they are, in a spiritual sense, diseased states, we knew that already. If it means they are literally diseased, so that we're no more responsible for them than for measles or some kind of insanity, we all know this to be untrue. Which of us for one single day can live with those he loves best and not feel the impulse to demand much and to give little, to love them rather as extensions of ourselves than as free souls for whom we and all things were made? These temptations, in fact, are on a par with all our others. We might as well call it a neurosis when I stay in bed too long in the morning, or snap back, or take more than my fair share of the strawberries. To be a self is ipso facto to be potentially selfish. If you're going to call all this neurosis, the real name of that neurosis is being a fallen man. The old word sin was often used. Again, neurosis might imply that we needn't repent or labor to amend, but only have a treatment. Now, of course, it's true that in particular cases there is a real neurosis. There are causes outside the offender's consciousness which make impossible to him what is hard to all, or which at least make it harder for him to resist these temptations and make his behavior worse when he yields. On that peculiarity, therapeutics may work. But it's working on the peculiar aggravation of something which is both normal and detestable. The peculiarity may perhaps be cured. But the radical, the congenitally human selfishness behind it is not a question of cure in that sense. Medicine labors to preserve or restore natural structure or normal function. But greed and pride aren't unnatural or abnormal in the same sense as astigmatism or a floating kidney. For who in heaven's name could describe as normal or natural in the medical sense the soul from which they were totally absent? Natural in a quite different sense, if you like, arch-natural, seen only once since the fall, and certainly not at all like the psychologist's picture of the integrated, adjusted, balanced, happily married, satisfactorily employed, popular, regular citizen. You can't really be so well adjusted to your world, you know, if it ends by nailing you up to a stake of wood. But long before this, I expect, some listener wants to interrupt me with the protest, I thought you defined Storgy as a kind of love. All these horrors you've been describing are not love at all, they're unlove. And of course, such a listener is perfectly right. One way of treating my subject would be to say that just as there is none good but God and nothing good but
imagine everyone was thinking that before we began, and I shall have failed with everyone who isn't thinking it by the end. And after all, Storge, even in its depraved condition, has many of the characteristics of what we call love in ordinary speech. It desires some good for its object. It feels pain when the object is absent, though not always pleasure when it's present, and anxiety when the object is in danger. And by a peculiar paradox, which would be comic if it weren't so very miserable, it may feel lasting sorrow on being bereaved of one with whom the mourner passed hardly a day unmarred by quarrels. For Storge is great at laying flowers and graves and keeping anniversaries, sometimes far better at lamenting you when you're dead than being fair to you while you're alive. This is the reason, I think, why one often feels disgust at many of the sentimental songs about Storge, like Home Sweet Home. They treat as holy something which is rarely capable of and in need of sanctification. The songs are, in a word, idolatrous. They make Storge a goddess. Those who treat Storge like a goddess are her enemies as well as ours. It concludes what I have to say about Storge, and now I change my subject and go over to my next theme, philia, or friendship. In our age, it's much harder to talk about this than about Storge and Eros. When those are your theme, you'll find a prepared audience. Their importance and beauty and value have been stressed and indeed exaggerated again and again. But very few modern people think friendship a relation of comparable importance. We readily admit that besides a wife and family, a man wants a few friends. But the very tone of the admission, the very meaning it gives to the word friend, make it clear that friendship is very far from being regarded as a main course in life's banquet, or even a course at all. It's more like the bread you crumble almost unconsciously during a long dinner. It's one of the etc. Why this has happened is well worth inquiry. The first and most obvious answer is that most people don't think about it because a great many people don't experience it. It's hard to get through life without encountering some kind and degree of both Eros and Storge. And of course it's impossible that life should go on unless many people felt both, because without Eros none of us would be forgotten, and without Storge none of us would be reared. The peculiarity of friendship is that it's not unavoidable. Thousands of people have lived and died without knowing it. To be sure, 900 of each 1,000 will have had what we commonly call friends. People they drink with and play games with and chat with and cooperate with, perhaps amicably enough in their profession. But this useful and pleasant relationship is not of itself what I mean by friendship. There's lately arisen, too, a much nastier bit of evidence to show that the experience of philia is not universal. I mean, of course, the fact that if you speak of it with any seriousness, you are now quite likely to be suspected of homosexuality. This is extremely revealing. It doesn't at all prove that those who bring the charge are homosexual themselves. Nor would I moralize upon them if they were. How a man can feel anything but bewildered pity for the genuinely homosexual, I've never been able to understand. What it does prove is that they've either never known friendship or never known Eros. For I appeal to everyone who's known both to bear me witness that in some ways, nothing is so unlike a friendship as a love affair. Lovers talk incessantly about them. That. The characteristic posture of lovers is face to face, that of friends side by side. Admittedly, friendship between man and woman can turn into love. But the very fact that people speak of turning into implies the difference. Of course, it's not to be denied that just as philia and normal Eros may be united in the relationship of a man to a woman, so philia and perverse Eros may be blended in a relation between persons of the same sex. In certain cultures, at certain periods, this has been common. In warlike societies, homosexuality, especially likely, to creep into the relation between the mature brave and his young armor-bearer or squire. The Greek tradition of high heroic friendship is widely infected with paederasty. But things which can coexist are not therefore necessarily the same. They may in the long run be antagonistic. What might possibly confuse the issue is the fact that until quite modern times, male friendship normally expressed itself through kisses, embraces, and tears. Such behavior might be connected with a repressed erotic element, but no one with any historical sense could suppose this was always so. Its very prevalence proves the opposite. The erotic diagnosis has implications too comic to be accepted. I can't believe that Johnson embraced Boswell for that reason. The truth is, of course, that what needs explaining, what is anomalous and eccentric, is not the demonstrative gestures of old friendship, but the apparent coldness of ours. The marked repugnance which I, like many moderns, feel for any close physical contact with my own sex may itself be mildly pathological. Now, this modern suspicion of friendship by the amateur psychological wiseacres, the modern indifference to it shown by nearly everyone, the possibility of passing a whole life without experience of it, and the immense prestige which it once enjoyed and has now lost, are not unrelated phenomena. They all spring from one fact, the fact that philia is, in one sense, the least natural of the loves. It has least commerce with our nervous system. There's nothing throaty about it, nothing that quickens the pulse or makes you red or pale. It's not, in its full development, a biological necessity. The individual can live and breed and protect himself without it. Eros and Storge are too obviously connected with the body, too widely shared with the beasts, too closely linked with biological necessity. In them, one could almost feel that nature pulls the strings and we are the puppets. In philia, on the other hand, we have the feeling, whether illusory or not, of being free from all that. Hence, friendship alone of all the loves seemed to our ancestors to raise us to the level of gods or angels. Thus, some men have exalted and others have depreciated or denied the love called philia for exactly the same reason, because in it man seems furthest removed from the animal, from the irrational, and from necessity. This does not seem to me a good ground either for praising it or disparaging it, for, as I said before, nothing in man is either better or worse because he shares it with the beasts. Nor does anything need to be justified by its survival value. The things which make survival worth having are not to be rated below the things which enable us to survive. If everything that's not harnessed to the biological wagon is to be called perversion, then we must say, as I said before, that humanity itself, and the more human the more so, is the greatest perversion of all. I was saying last time that friendship, or philia as the Greeks call it, was in a way the least natural of our loves, the least biological. But of course it has its prehistoric matrix and biological roots, just as sexual love and maternal affection have. Only in its case, the flower is further away from the roots. In early communities, the cooperation of the males as hunters or fighters was no less necessary than the begetting and rearing of children. Long before history began, we men had got together apart from the women and done things. We had to. We not only had to do the things, we had to talk about them. We had to plan the hunter fight. When they were over, we had to hold a post-mortem and draw conclusions for future use. We liked this even better. In all these pleasures, there was a savour quite different from anything we usually experienced in our relationships with the women. Meanwhile, of course, the women were doing things together apart from us. Being a man, I naturally know less what they were like. But I know, as all men know, in my very bones, what the men were doing. As some wag said, the caveman may or may not have had a club on his shoulder, but he quite certainly had a club in the other sense, a place where he sat and talked, and talked. It was very probably part of his religion. But all this is not yet friendship. I don't at all want to undervalue the merely clubbable element in our lives. It's necessary. And perhaps of all relationships, camaraderie produces the fewest pains and the most pleasures, often wholly innocent and recreative pleasures. A life without it would be crippled. And for my own part, heart over the deepest suspicions of those wretched people who find no pleasure in the society of their own sex. Heaven protect me from the man who needs only women and the woman who needs only men. But at the same time, we must insist that friendship is not simply camaraderie or companionship. Those who don't experience friendship or philia proper think that friend means only comrade or companion, one with whom we can collaborate easily or spend our leisure agreeably. But those who know philia make a distinction. Among their 100 or so comrades, only 5 or 6 may be in the true sense friends. Of course, in ordinary conversation, they apply the word friends to the whole 100. But that is a façon de parler, a polite fiction, like the adjective dear at the beginning of a letter. Those whose society we enjoy may fail in 2 different ways to qualify for the title of friends. First, we may enjoy a man's conversation without liking the man. He may be highly intelligent or amusing. So long as he will talk on a subject we want to learn about, or so long as he makes good jokes, we may be delighted. The moment the conversation moves on to a deeper level and forces us to attend to his personality, we may be repelled. We may even receive from him pleasures we're ashamed of, as when we listen to a scandalmonger. There are, it's true, people who seem never to make this distinction. Liking a man and liking his talk are for them all one. The confusion is elementary, but we needn't be surprised at it when we remember that other people can't distinguish between liking an actor's performance and liking the actor as a man, nor between enjoying a book and imagining that they like the author. But everyone can understand the opposite situation, in which we like the man, but find his society rather dull. And so also there are wits whom we enjoy without love, without esteem, and without confidence. Secondly, there may be a man with whom, while we live in the same place or share the same job, while we have the same recreations, we seem to be in the relation of friendship. Then the chances of life separate us. We meet him 5 years later, and find that when the first delighted greetings have passed and a few reminiscences have been interchanged, we have hardly a word to say to him, nor he to us. Neither of us need have changed at all seriously in character, yet both have mistaken for a deep union of personalities what was really only a common stock of aims, hardships, hopes, fears, triumphs, annoyances, and jokes, externally provided by the place or job they happen to share. Now, it's just here that the friend is most clearly distinguishable from the companion. After almost any tract of time or any change of residence or occupation, the old unity will be intact. Everything will be taken up again as if we'd been parted only for a few hours. We've no need to fall back on reminiscences, though we may do so for the pleasure of it, but we're not reduced to them, whereas the attempted revival of mere companionship has no other cause. The difference between mere companionship and friendship depends on the nature of the shared activity. The men of the tribe sit talking together because they are all hunters and warriors. Take the individuals apart, place them for a few years in different cultures, using different techniques, facing different problems, and then reassemble them. I very much doubt if the old companionship, the old club, would come to life again. For the bond of union lay in their functions, not in the personalities of each. But if in that prehistoric club there had been 2 who went sometimes apart to talk of something which the rest had no bent for, two who were groping their way towards the beginnings of art or philosophy or religion, then I should expect that those 2, at such a reunion as I'm imagining, would resume their old relationship. They are linked together not as warriors or trappers, but as men, as the very 2 men they were and are. The activity they shared, they always will share as long as they are the same men. As Montaigne says, a man is my friend because he is he, because I am I. Whereas a man is my comrade because he is my colleague or neighbor or ally. But does not Eros, does not the love between man and woman also say, because she is she, because I am I? Certainly, but Eros doesn't mean quite the same thing. Eros means, because she is my goal, my journey's end, my quarry.
because I need her and she me, because we are key and lock, thirst and water, seal and wax. But friendship means because he has the same goal, because he is taking the same journey, because he is hunting the same quarry, because we are both filled with the same need. I am speaking, of course, of Eros here in a sort of chemical purity from which, thank God, he is usually preserved in ordinary life, where happy Eros is nearly always combined with storge and very often with friendship too. Now, by saying that Eros can be combined with friendship, I have, you noticed, assumed that there can be friendship between a man and a woman. There are people who don't believe this. They think that any apparent instance of it is usually a disguise for Eros or the beginning of Eros. And there are also people who think there are no true friendships between women and women. Both views are, in my opinion, wrong as generalizations, but I am afraid they are likely enough to be true of many societies or classes within societies at certain periods. Companionship is the soil out of which friendships grow, and where the soil is lacking, of course, the plant will not exist. Where men work and women don't, or where they do quite different work, or again, where men are educated and women not, or where the sexes have different educations, there will be no companionship, and therefore no friendships between the sexes. They can meet only in Eros and Storge. For I don't think lovers can be, in the true sense, friends as well as lovers, unless they are the sort of man and the sort of woman who would have been friends even if they had not fallen in love. Though there was no companionship between the sexes, the women have had their own companionship parallel to and distinct from that of the men. In many primitive communities, they go together to the washing pools or to sow the fields. A whole female life with its own labors, rituals, sometimes even its own language is built up, and the men are as jealously excluded from it as the women are from theirs. That is one possible and tolerable state of affairs. Friendships between women and women, friendships between men and men, but none between the sexes. Another possible state of affairs, which I like very much better, is that which we see nowadays in those societies where men and women, rarely equal in education, collaborate in the same professions and have the same tastes. Real friendships can then arise both between women and women, and between women and between men and men. But unfortunately, there are in the modern world quite a number of women who get the benefit of neither system. Such is many a well-to-do married woman in our own professional classes. What work she does, and labor-saving gimmicks have left her little to do, is done alone in her own flat or house. Other women are not her colleagues or comrades. They're merely visitors or neighbors. On the other hand, she may be totally unfitted for any real companionship, hence for any real friendship, either with her husband or with any of his circle. Of course, she has had what is officially, almost ironically, called an education. But if her husband and his friends are, say, doctors, clergymen, lawyers, scholars, or scientists, she is, for all the practical purposes of companionship with them, uneducated. They can't talk to her about the sort of things friends talk about. I don't mean merely the shop on their particular professions, but the whole world of ideas which presupposes a highly educated mind. Of course, affectionate husbands and polite, long-suffering friends will pretend it is otherwise. And, of course, an aggressive woman will insist on being treated as if it were otherwise. But neither expedient helps. She can be taken to the right party. She may be laboriously dragged into the conversation. Her interruptions and misunderstandings may be endured with smiling patience. But she hasn't really got into the circle. The moment she joins it, it ceases to be the circle it was. Her very presence destroys it. She has frustrated the others and is frustrated herself. One cannot be surprised if she comes in the end to hate and fear friendship as the enemy of Eros and Storge, the only love she can ever really have. I'm very sorry for the woman in this position. she has fallen between two stools, has lost the old camaraderie with her own sex, yet not advanced to the stage in which she could be the friend on a different level, either of women or of men. But I not only pity her, I also fear her. A huge, glossy, and expensive weekly and monthly literature now exists for just such women. Through that, her fear and hatred of philia may be becoming influential. Friendship is a development from mere companionship or camaraderie. It could indeed be defined as companionship transferred to a deeper level, transferred to those desires, fears, hopes, or delights which make us the precise people we are. Hence, the very first step in friendship is not a movement of liking towards another man. That is the second step. First comes the shared activity. To care about something other than friends, even if it were only a hobby, is the precondition of friendship. If you're going nowhere, you can have no traveling companions. If you've nothing to share, you can share nothing. Friendships always come, if they come at all, unasked, unsought, as Keble said. Friends don't talk much about one another, nor about their friendship. On the eve of a long parting, in danger, in sorrow, they may express the deep love and unshakable loyalty that's between them. The very rarity of such explicitness may even make it especially poignant. But friendship would lose its essential character if they were frequent. The fact that friendship is thus normally unexpressed and merely implicit helps to conceal from some observers the truth that it's a form of love at all. It is manifest far more in its results than in any direct emotional impact, as a man's love of God is better gauged by the tenor of his whole life than by his moments of what the theologians call sensible consolation. This comes out strongly in its reaction to bereavement. We may feel, in one sense, and at the moment, the death of a great friend less than the death of someone or something which we love with very moderate storge, even an animal. The one may fill our eyes with tears, the other not. But the death of the object loved with storge may, after that momentary and not wholly painful tenderness, make hardly any difference to our lives. The death of a friend may impoverish us every year or every month till we die. We're like a man who has lost a limb. The stump may not ache, or not much, but no more tennis, no more mountain walks. Write it all off. Again, the seriousness and importance of friendship is masked for some people by a characteristic which is really its glory. It is unnecessary. It is arbitrary, a thing of choice. We are no way obliged to make any man a friend, and we have no claim that any man should become ours. It is more nearly disinterested than any other love. Friends may be useful and may increase our happiness, but it's impossible to make them our friends with this in view. In a word, it's free. And with this freedom goes a certain noble irresponsibility. I hope the word won't be misunderstood. Of course, we have responsibilities to every man. Every man is his brother's keeper. And if to leave any man unhelped or uncomforted when help and comfort are in our power is bad, so to leave a friend is worse. But such good offices are not the stuff of friendship. They're a byproduct. The mark of perfect friendship is not that help will be given, of course it will, when the pinch comes, but that, having been given, it makes no difference at all. It was an anomaly, a distraction. It has interrupted the conversation. For, of course, friends don't want to know one another's affairs at all. You can become friends with a man before you know whether he's married or single or how he earns his living. In a circle of true friends, each man stands for nothing but what he is. No one cares about anyone else's family or professional status or class or regional origin or nationality or previous history. In fact, all the things biographers want to know, they care nothing about. In time, of course, all these things will be revealed, but not for their own sake. They will come in accidentally. That is the delight of philia, the contact of stripped or disentangled souls. For Eros, naked bodies. For friendship, naked personalities. You'll notice that I've passed inevitably from speaking of a pair of friends to speaking of a group. Two is not, in fact, the perfect number for friendship. Hence, though jealousy can creep in here as where not, friendship is by nature the least jealous of all loves. Two friends will be glad to be joined by a third, and three by a fourth. When two or three or five of us, after a hard day's walking, have come to our inn, when our slippers are on and our feet spread out towards the blaze, and our drinks are at our elbows, and the whole world and something beyond the world opens itself to our minds, and no one has any claim on or any responsibility for any of the others, but all freemen and equals as if we just met half an hour ago, while nonetheless an affection mellowed by the years is there and fills up the chinks, then we may well wonder whether on the natural level there is anything better than this. And of course, in a sense, nothing is. Nothing is ever better than what's best in its own kind. The greatest wine cannot be better than a slice of perfectly good bread. It's no wonder, then, that past ages thought friendship the crown of life. It is the least jealous, the least demanding of loves, almost free from self-interest, immune from the internal corruptions of story. It can, as the ancients thought, be a school of virtue. If men are good at all, they become better by mutual friendship. Each lives up to all the rest. We could easily be tempted to regard it, not merely as an analogy to, but a real foretaste of the heavenly unity. Notice, however, that Scripture has not chosen this sort of love as the symbol of divine love. It has chosen Storge, God is our Father, and we his sons. It has chosen Eros, Christ is the bridegroom of the church. More than that, the most completely animal and self-regarding of all our appetites has been chosen to become the vehicle of our most strictly commanded communion with God. Eat this, drink this. It looks as if God, or God's plans for our redemption, were not in the common sense of the word half so spiritual as the higher paganism supposed. He seems to descend deepest into nature when he intends to lift us highest. Blood and guts and glands and genes and things of that sort don't repel him. Negative spirituality, departure from the animal and the instinctive, doesn't of itself seem to please him particularly. By its spirituality, friendship escapes some of the obvious dangers of the other loves. Its danger lies precisely in its spirituality. Consider how a circle of friends, such as I've been describing, appears from outside. Almost every name given to it is in some degree unpleasant. It's a set, a coterie, a gang, a mutual admiration society. To belong to a group of real friends is to be armed, in a degree which friendless men can't imagine, against influences from without. The public opinion within the group may be tiny, but it matters more than the opinion of 10,000 outsiders. The approval of those whom we love and honor is the approval we value. Every knot of friends is thus a resistance movement. And, of course, the external pressures which it arms us to resist may be good ones or bad ones. In it we may retreat into something better or worse than the public world. It may be a nursery of martyrs or of criminals. In real life, friendship can unite by what is still good in them, men otherwise very bad, and thus fortify them in evil. There can, for example, be an aristocratic caste, very cruel and unjust to the rest of the world, but quite genuinely united within by friendships, mutual loves, honor, and courtesy. The more real and even lofty the friendship within such a caste is, the more it may steel their nerves and stop their ears to all claims from without. The same man who would die for his brother in arms might not deny himself one bottle of wine or one game of cards to save a village of peasants from massacre. The sufferings and the moral judgments of outsiders don't affect him. It's the approval of his friends that matters. Friendship, as we've seen, is based on sharing at depth of activities and attitudes, a relation between souls side by side. The things shared may be good or bad or mixed. Friendship doesn't transform them. It raises them, for good or ill, to a higher power and gives them more confidence. It makes brave men braver, kind men kinder, pious men more pious, cruel men more cruel, proud men more proud. It underlines, endorses, sanctions, defends either from cruel or from false shame, whatever they were doing already. If you and I want to evade some dangerous duty, the best plan is to find two or three other cowards and do our shirking in company. It's wonderful how little discomfort you'll feel when we've talked it all over and laughed it all over together. Equally, if we have to stand out against a real evil, to risk embarrassment and jeers and the possible loss of a job, the best plan is to get together with two or three other honest men. The ordeal will become amazingly less formidable. Friends, in a word, give us moral support, or immoral support. I've glanced at extreme examples, but they're extremes of a moral ambivalence which is inherent in friendship. It can be a school of individual humility, but with this individual humility, how easily there comes a corporate pride. I may be unworthy, but we, the set, are magnificent. Loyalty to the spirit of a noble circle, adherence to its standards, has so often proved for us the road to goodness that we may come to mistake it for goodness itself. To stand by our friends, to stick to the firm, to go down with the ship, these things being almost absolutes, may become absolutes. Aucassin in the story said he would rather go to hell with the knights and ladies and troubadours than to heaven with the hermits. Now a man must be very good, or, and that's the trouble, very bad, not to feel in himself a response to that gesture. A kind of heroic loyalty is often mixed with that corporate impenitence which binds bad men together in their last stand. Friendship is a resistance movement. It can resist God as well as society. And yet all the time by a kind of goodness, or what had been goodness in it. Friendship is the most spiritual loves, and therefore its corruption the most spiritual corruption. A certain kind of mother may be like a man-eating tigress, a certain kind of lover like a rutting animal. Storge and Eros can fall by animality. But friendship gone wrong liberates not the animal in man, but the titanic or diabolical. It is high-minded. It can have proud looks. By its nature, it must and should defy popular opinion. It may go on to defy mercy and justice and God.